Strangely, the same folk who had said with bare politeness that they had no use for begemmed necklaces went round-eyed at the unset stones rolling about in Avienda's palm. Rihanna said they saw one as frippery, the other as wealth, but whatever their reasons, in return for 2 rubies of moderate size, 1 large moonstone, and a small fire-drop, the people of Foral Market were more than willing to provide as many thick woolens as their visitors desired, some of them hardly worn. "Very generous of them," Nynaeve muttered sourly as people began rooting clothes out of their chests and attics. A steady stream marched into the inn with their arms full. Those stones could buy the whole village. Avienda shrugged slightly. She would have surrendered a handful of the gems if Rihanna had not intervened. Marilla shook her head. "We have what they want, but they have what we need. I'm afraid that means they set the price." Which was entirely too much like the situation with the sea folk. Nynaeve looked positively ill. When they were alone in a hallway of the inn, Elaine asked Avienda where she had gotten such a fortune in jewels, and one she seemed eager to be rid of. She expected her near sister to say they were her takings from the Stone of Tyr, or perhaps Cairion. "Randall Thor tricked me," Avienda muttered sullenly. "I tried to buy my toe from him. I know that is the least honorable way," she protested, "but I could see no other. And he stood me on my head. Why is it when you reason things out logically, a man always does something completely illogical and gains the upper hand?" "Their pretty heads are so fuzzy, a woman can't expect to follow how they skitter," Elaine told her. She did not inquire what toe Avienda had tried to buy, or how the attempt had ended with her near sister possessing a sack full of rich gems. Talking about Rand was hard enough without where that might lead. Snow brought more than a need for warm clothing. At midday, with the snow flurries falling thicker by the minute, Renila strode down the stairs into the common room, proclaimed that her part of the bargain had been met, and demanded not only the bowl of the winds, but Marilla. The Grey Sister stared in consternation, and so did a great many others. The benches were filled with kinswomen taking their turn at the midday meal, and serving men and women ran to serve this third lot of meals. Renila did not keep her voice down, and every head in the common room swiveled toward her. "You can begin your teaching now," Renila told the wide-eyed Aes Sedai. "Up the ladder with you to my quarters." Marilla started to protest, but face suddenly cold, the windfinder to the mistress of the ships planted fists on her hips. "When I give a command, Marilla Cian Devon," she said icily, "I expect every hand on deck to jump. Now jump!" Marilla did not precisely jump, but she did gather herself and go, with Renila practically chivying her up the stairs from behind. Given her promise, she had no other choice. Rihanna's face was aghast. Alice and stout Sumiko, still wearing her red belt, watched thoughtfully. In the days that followed, whether laboring along a snow-covered road on their horses, walking the streets of a village, or trying to find room for everyone at a farm, Renila kept Marilla at her heels, except when she told her off to follow another windfinder. The glow of Sidar surrounded the Grey Sister and her escort almost constantly, and Marilla demonstrated weaves unceasingly. The pale Cairienin was markedly shorter than any of the dark sea folk women, but at first Marilla managed to stand taller by the sheer force of Aes Sedai dignity. Soon, though, she began to wear a permanently startled expression. Elaine learned that when they all had beds to sleep in, which they did not always, Marilla was sharing with Paul, her maid, and the 2 apprentice windfinders, Talan and Metara. What that said of Marilla's status, Elaine was not sure. Clearly the windfinders did not put her on a level with the apprentices. They just expected her to do as she was told, when she was told, with no delays or equivocations. Rihanna remained appalled at the turn of events, but Elise and Sumiko were not the only ones among the kin to watch closely, not the only ones to nod thoughtfully. And suddenly another problem came to Elaine's notice. The kinswomen saw Ispan made more and more malleable in her captivity, but she was the prisoner of other Aes Sedai. The sea folk were not Aes Sedai, and Marilla not a prisoner, yet she was starting to jump when Renila issued a command, or for that matter when Dorilla or Kyra, or Kyra's blood sister Tibrela did. Each of those was windfinder to a clan wave mistress, and none of the others made her hop with such alacrity, but that was enough. More and more of the kin slid from horrified gaping to thoughtful observation. Perhaps Aes Sedai were not a different flesh after all. If Aes Sedai were just women like themselves, why should they subject themselves once more to the rigors of the tower, to Aes Sedai authority and Aes Sedai discipline? Had they not survived very well on their own? Some for more years than any of the older sisters were quite ready to believe. Elaine could practically see the idea forming in their heads. When she mentioned it to Nynaeve, though, Nynaeve just muttered, "About time some of the sisters learned what it's like trying to teach a woman who thinks she knows more than her teacher. Those who have a chance at a shawl will still want it. And for the rest, I don't see why they shouldn't grow some backbone." Elaine refrained from mentioning Nynaeve's complaints about Sumiko, who had certainly grown backbone. Sumiko had criticized several of Nynaeve's healing weaves as clumsy, and Elaine had thought Nynaeve was going to have apoplexy on the spot. "In any case, there's no need to tell Egwene about this, if she's there. Any of it. She has enough on her plate." Without doubt, any of it referred to Merilila and the Windfinders. They were in their shifts, seated on their bed on the second floor of the new plow, with the twisted ring Dream Turangrial hanging about their necks, Elaine's on a simple leather cord, Nynaeve's alongside Lan's heavy signet ring on a narrow golden chain. Avienda and Birgitta, still fully dressed, sat on two of their clothing chests. Standing guard, they called it, until she and Nynaeve returned from the world of dreams. Both wore their cloaks until they could climb under the blankets. The new plow was definitely not new. Cracks spidered across the plastered walls, and unfortunate drafts crept in everywhere. The room itself was small, and the chests and stacked bundles left room for little beyond the bed and washstand. Elaine knew she had to present herself properly in Camelin, but sometimes she felt guilty, with her belongings on pack animals, when most others had to make do with what they could carry on their backs. Nynaeve certainly never showed any regrets over her chests. They had been 16 days on the road. The full moon outside the narrow window shone on a white blanket of snow that would make traveling tomorrow slow, even if the sky remained clear, and Elaine thought another week to Camelin was an optimistic estimate. "I have enough sense not to remind her," she told Nynaeve. "I don't want my nose snapped off again." That was a mild way of putting it. They had not been in Telairunriod since informing Egwene, the night after leaving the estate, that the bowl had been used. Reluctantly, they also had told her of the bargain they had been forced into with the sea folk, and found themselves facing the Armerlin seat, with the striped stole on her shoulders. Elaine knew it was necessary and right. A queen's closest friend among her subjects knew she was the queen as well as a friend. Had to know. But she had not enjoyed her friend telling them in a heated voice that they had behaved like witless lubies who might have brought ruin down on all their heads, especially when she herself agreed. She had not liked hearing that the only reason Egwene did not set them both a penance that would curl their hair was that she could not afford to have them waste the time. Necessary and right, though. When she sat on the Lion Throne, she would still be Aes Sedai, and subject to the laws and rules and customs of Aes Sedai. Not for Andor. She would not give her land to the White Tower, but for herself. So, unpleasant as it had been, she accepted her castigation calmly. Nynaeve had writhed and stammered with embarrassment, protested and all but pouted, then apologized so profusely that Elaine hardly believed it was the same woman she knew. Quite rightly, Egwene had remained the Armerlin, cool in her displeasure, even while giving pardon for their mistakes. At best, tonight could not be pleasant or comfortable if she was there. But when they dreamed themselves into the Salidar of Telairunriod, into the room in the little tower that had been called the Armerlin's study, she was not there, and the only sign she had visited since their meeting was some barely visible words, roughly scratched on a beetle-riddled wall panel, as if by an idle hand that did not want to spend the effort to carve deeply. "Stay in Camelin," and a few feet away, "Keep silent and be careful." Those had been Egwene's final instructions to them. Go to Camelin and stay there until she could puzzle out how to keep the hall from salting all of them down and nailing them into a barrel. a reminder they had no way to erase. Embracing Sidar, Elaine channeled to leave her own message, the number 15 seemingly scratched on the heavy table that had been Egwene's writing desk. Inverting the weave and tying it off meant that only someone who ran her fingers across the numerals would realize they were not really there. Perhaps it would not take 15 days to reach Camelin, but more than a week, she was certain. Nynaeve strode to the window and peered out both ways, careful not to put her head out through the open casement. It was night out there, as in the waking world, a full moon gleaming on bright snow, though the air did not feel cold. No one else should be there except them, and if anyone was, it was someone to avoid. "I hope she isn't having trouble with her plans," she muttered. "She told us not to mention those even to each other, Nynaeve. A secret spoken finds wings." That had been another of Linny's many favorites. Nynaeve grimaced over her shoulder, then returned to peering down the narrow alley. "It's different for you. I tended her as a child, changed her swaddling, smacked her bottom a time or two, and now I have to leap when she snaps her fingers. It's hard." Elaine could not help herself. She snapped her fingers. Nynaeve spun so fast that she blurred, her face pop-eyed with horror. Her dress blurred, too, from blue riding silks to an accepted's banded white to what she referred to as good, stout, two-rivers wool, dark and thick. When she realized Egwene was not there, had not been listening, she almost fainted with relief. When they stepped back to their bodies and woke long enough to tell the others they could come to bed, Avienda certainly thought it a good joke, and Birgitta laughed as well. Nynaeve had her revenge, though. The next morning she woke Elaine with an icicle. Elaine's shrieks woke everybody else in the whole village. 3 days later the first explosion came.
Chapter 21. Answering the Summons. The great winter tempest called the Semaros continued to roll up out of the Sea of Storms, harsher than any in memory. Some said this year the Semaros were trying to make up for the months of delay. Lightning crackled across the skies, enough to make the darkness patchy at night. Wind lashed the land and rain flailed it, turning all but the hardest roads to rivers of mud. Sometimes the mud froze after nightfall, but sunrise always brought a thaw, even under a gray sky, and the ground became bogs once more. Rand was surprised at how much all that hampered his plans. The Ashaman he had sent for came quickly, at mid-morning the next day, riding out of a gateway into a driving downpour that obscured the sun so that it might as well have been twilight. Through the hole in the air, snow fell back in Andor, fat white flakes swirling about thickly and hiding what lay behind them. Most of the men in the short column were bundled in heavy black cloaks, but the rain seemed to slip around them and their horses. It was not obvious, yet anyone who noticed would look twice, if not three times. Keeping dry required only a simple weave, so long as you did not mind flaunting what you were. But then, the black and white disc worked on a crimson circle on the breast of their cloaks did that. Even half hidden by the rain, there was a pride about them, an arrogance in the way they sat their saddles, a defiance. They gloried in what they were. Their commander, Charles Gedwin, was a few years older than Rand, of middling height and wearing the sword and dragon like Torval, on a very well-cut high-collared coat of the best black silk. His sword was mounted lushly with silver, his silver-worked sword belt fastened with a silver buckle shaped in a clenched fist. Gedwin termed himself Tzorovan Mihail, in the old tongue, Storm Leader, whatever that was supposed to mean. It seemed appropriate to the weather, at least. Even so, he stood just inside the entrance to Rand's ornate green tent and scowled out at the cascading rain. A guard of mounted companions encircled the tent, no more than 30 paces away, yet they were barely visible. They might have been statues, ignoring the torrent. "How do you expect me to find anyone in this?" Gedwin muttered, glancing back over his shoulder at Rand. A tick late, he added, "My lord dragon." His eyes were hard and challenging, but they always were, whether looking at a man or a fence-post. "Rochide and I brought 8 dedicated and 40 soldiers, enough to destroy an army, or cow, 10 kings. We might even make an Aes Sedai blink," he said wryly. "Burn me, the pair of us could do a fair job alone, or you could. Why do you need anyone else?" "I expect you to obey," Gedwin," Rand said coldly. "Storm leader?" "And Manal Rochide, Gedwin's second, called himself, by John Mahale, attack leader. What was Taim up to, creating new ranks? The important thing was that the man made weapons. The important thing was that the weapons stayed sane long enough to be used. And I don't expect you to waste time questioning my orders." "As you command, my lord dragon," Gedwin muttered. "I'll send men out immediately." With a curt salute, fist to chest, he strode out into the storm. The deluge bent away from him, sheeting down the small shield he wove around himself. Rand wondered whether the man suspected how close he had come to dying when he seized Saiyadin without warning.
"You must kill him before he kills you," Luz-Theron giggled. "They will, you know. Dead men can't betray anyone."
The voice in Rand's head turned wondering.
"But sometimes they don't die. Am I dead? Are you?"
Rand pushed the words down to a fly's buzzing, just on the edge of notice. Since his reappearance inside Rand's head, Luz-Theron seldom went silent unless forced. The man seemed madder than ever most of the time, and usually angrier as well. Stronger sometimes, too. That voice invaded Rand's dreams, and when he saw himself in a dream, it was not always himself at all that he saw. It was not always Luz-Theron, either, the face he had come to recognize as Luz-Theron's. Sometimes it was blurred, yet vaguely familiar, and Luz-Theron seemed startled by it, too. That was an indication how far the man's madness went, or maybe his own.
"Not yet," Rand thought. "I can't afford to go mad yet."
"When then?" Luz-Theron whispered before Rand could mute him again. With the arrival of Gedwin and the Ashaman, his plan to sweep the Shonchan westward got underway. Got underway and crept forward as slowly as a man laboring along one of those mired roads. He shifted his own camp at once, making no effort to hide his movements. There was little point to straining for secrecy. Word traveled slowly by pigeon and far slower by courier once the Samaros came, yet he had no doubts he was watched, by the White Tower, by the Forsaken, by anyone who saw gain or loss in where the Dragon Reborn went, and could afford to slip coin to a soldier. Maybe even by the Shonchan. If he could scout them, why not they him? But not even the Ashaman knew why he was moving. While Rand was idly watching men fold his tent onto a high-wheeled cart, Wyraman appeared on one of his many horses, a prancing white gelding of the finest Tyran bloodstock. The rain had cleared, though gray clouds still veiled the noonday sun, and the air felt as if you could squeeze water out of it with your hands. The dragon banner and the banner of light hung limp and sodden on their tall staffs. Tyran defenders had replaced the companions, and as Wyraman rode through their mounted ring, he frowned at Rodrivar Tihera, a lean fellow, dark even for a Tyran, with a short beard trimmed to a very sharp point. A very minor noble who had had to rise through his abilities, Tihera was punctilious in the extreme. The fat white plumes bobbing on his rimmed helmet added embellishment to the elaborate bow he gave Wyraman. The High Lord's frown deepened. There was no need for the Captain of the Stone to be personally in charge of Rand's bodyguard, but he frequently was, just as Marklin often commanded the companions himself. And often bitter rivalry had grown up between defenders and companions, centering on who should guard Rand. The Tyrans claimed the right because he had ruled longer in Tyr, the Ilioners because he was, after all, King of Ilion. Perhaps Wyraman had heard some of the mutters among the defenders that it was time Tyr had a king of its own, and who better than the man who had taken the stone? Wyraman more than agreed with the need, but not with the choice of who should wear the crown. He was not the only one. The man smoothed his features as soon as he saw Rand looking, and swung down from his gold-tooled saddle to offer a bow that made Tihera's seem simple. Iron-spined as he was, he could puff up and strut in his sleep, though he did grimace slightly at putting his polished boot into the mud. He wore a rain cape to keep the mist off his fine clothes, but even that was encrusted with gold embroidery and had a collar of sapphires. For all of Rand's coat of deep green silk with golden bees climbing the sleeves and lapels, anyone might have been forgiven for thinking the crown of swords belonged on the other's head, not his.
"My lord dragon," Wyraman intoned. "I cannot express how happy I am to see you guarded by tyrants, my lord dragon."
Surely the world would weep if anything untoward happened.
He was too intelligent to come out and call the companions untrustworthy. By a hair, he was.
Sooner or later it would, Rand said dryly, after a good part of it finished celebrating.
I know how hard you'd cry, Wireman. The fellow actually preened, stroking the point of his gray-streaked beard.
He heard what he wanted to hear.
Yes, my Lord Dragon, you can be assured of my constancy, which is why I'm concerned by the orders your man brought me this morning.
That was Adley. Many of the nobles thought pretending the Ashaman were merely Rand's servants would somehow make them less dangerous.
Wise of you to send away most of the Kyrianon. And the Ilioners, of course. That goes without saying. I can even understand why you limit Guayam and the others.
Wireman's boots squelched in the mud as he stepped nearer, and his voice took on a confiding tone.
I do believe some of them, I wouldn't say plotted against you, but I think perhaps their loyalty has not always been without question. As mine is, without question.
His voice shifted again, to strong and confident, a man concerned only with the needs of the one he served, the one who surely would make him the first king of Tyr.
Allow me to bring all of my armsmen, my Lord Dragon. With them and the defenders, I can assure the honor of the Lord of the Morning and his safety.
In all of the individual camps across the heath, wagons and carts were being loaded, horses saddled. Most tents were already down. The High Lady Rosanna was riding north, her banner heading a column large enough to raise havoc among the bandits and at least give the Shido pause, but not enough to plant notions in her head, especially not when half were Guayam's and Marakan's retainers, mixed with defenders of the stone. Much the same applied to Spira Naraton, riding eastward over the tall ridge with as many companions and men sworn to the others of the Council of Nine, as his own liegemen, not to mention 100 more tailing behind on foot, some of the fellows who had surrendered in the woods beyond that ridge the day before. A surprising number had chosen to follow the Dragon Reborn, but Rand did not trust them enough to leave them together. Tolmaran was just starting south with the same kind of blend, and others would be marching off as soon as they had their carts and wagons loaded. Each in a different direction, and none able to trust the men at their backs far enough for them to do more than follow the orders Rand had given. Bringing peace to Ilion was an important task, yet every last lord and lady regretted being sent away from the Dragon Reborn, plainly wondering whether it meant they had slipped in his trust. Though a few might have considered why he chose to keep those he did under his eye, Rosanna had certainly looked thoughtful.
"Your concern touches me," Rand told Wireman. "But how many bodyguards does one man need? I'm not off to start a war."
A fine point, perhaps, yet this war was well underway. It had begun at Falma, if not before.
"Get your people ready."
"How many have died for my pride?" Luce Theron moaned. "How many have died for my mistakes?"
"May I at least ask where we are going?"
Wireman's question, not quite exasperated, came right atop the voice in Rand's head.
"The city," Rand snapped.
He did not know how many had died for his mistakes, but none for his pride. He was sure of that. Wireman opened his mouth, plainly confused as to whether he meant Tyr or Ilion, or maybe even Kyrian. But Rand gestured him away with the dragon scepter, a sharp stabbing motion that made the green and white tassel swing. He half wished he could stab Luce Theron with it.
"I don't intend to sit here all day, Wireman. Go to your men."
Less than an hour later, he took hold of the true source and prepared to make a gateway for traveling. He had to fight the dizziness that gripped him lately whenever he seized or loosed the power. He did not quite sway in Tidashar's saddle. What with the molten filth floating on Saidine, the frozen slime, touching the source came close to emptying his stomach. Seeing double, even for only a few moments, made weaving flows difficult, if not impossible, and he could have told Dashiva or Flynn or one of the others to do it, but Gedwin and Rochide were holding their horses' reins in front of a dozen or so black-coated soldiers, all who had not been out to search. Just standing there patiently, and watching Rand. Rochide, no more than a hand shorter than Rand, and maybe 2 years younger, was also full Ashaman, and his coat, too, was silk. A small smile played on his face, as if he knew things others did not, and was amused. What did he know? About the Shonchan, surely, if not Rand's plans for them. What else?
Maybe nothing, but Rand was not about to show any weakness in front of that pair. The dizziness faded quickly, the twinned sight a little more slowly, as it always did these last few weeks, and he completed the weave, then, without waiting, dug in his heels, and rode through the opening that unfolded before him. The city he had meant was Ilion, though the gateway opened to the north of that city. Despite Wyrmann's supposed concerns, he hardly went unprotected and alone. Nearly 3,000 men rode through that tall square hole in the air, into rolling metal land, not far from the broad muddy road that led down to the causeway of the Northern Star. Even when every lord had only been allowed a handful of armsmen, to men accustomed to leading 1,000, if not thousands, 100 or so were a handful, they added up. Tyrans and Kyrianen and Ilioners, defenders of the stone under Tihera, and companions under Markalin, Ashaman healing Gedwin. The Ashaman who had come with him, anyway. Dashiva and Flynn and the rest kept their horses close behind Rand. All but Narishma. Narishma had not come back yet. The man knew where to find him, but Rand did not like it. Each kind kept to themselves as much as possible. Gwayem and Marakan and Aracombe rode with Wyrmann, all eyeing Rand more than where they were going. And Gregor and Panar, with three others of the Council of the Nine, leaning in their saddles to speak softly and uneasily among themselves. Samaradrid, with a knot of tight-faced Kyrianen lords behind him, watched Rand almost as closely as the Tyrans did. Rand had chosen those who came with him as carefully as those he sent away, not always for the reasons others might have used. Had there been any onlookers, it would have been a brave display, with all their bright banners and pennants, and small Khan rising from some of the Kyrianen's backs. Bright and brave and very dangerous. Some had plotted against him, and he had learned that Samaradrid's House Maravin had old alliances with House Riotan, which stood in open rebellion against him in Kyrian. Samaradrid did not deny the connection, but he had not mentioned it before Rand heard, either. The Council of Nine were just too new to him to risk leaving them all behind, and Wyrmann was a fool. Left to his own devices, he might well try to gain the Lord Dragon's favor by marching an army against the Shaun Chan, or Murundi, or the Light alone knew who or where. Too stupid to leave behind, too powerful to shove aside, so he rode with Rand, and thought himself honored. It was almost a pity he was not stupid enough to do something that would get him executed. Behind came the servants and carts. No one understood why Rand had sent all of the wagons with the others, and he was not about to explain. Who owned the next pair of ears that would hear? And then the long strings of spare mounts led by horse handlers, and straggling files of men in battered breastplates that did not quite fit, or leather jerkins sewn with rusty steel discs, carrying bows or crossbows or spears, and even a few pikes. More of the fellows who had obeyed Lord Bren's summons, and decided against going home unarmed. Their leader was the runny-nosed man Rand had spoken to on the edge of the woods, Egan Padros by name, and much brighter than he looked. It was difficult for a commoner to rise very far most places, but Rand had marked Padros out. The fellow gathered his men off to one side, but the whole lot of them milled about, elbowing one another aside for a better view southward. The causeway of the Northern Star stretched arrow straight through the miles of brown marsh that surrounded Ilion, a wide road of hard-packed dirt broken by flat stone bridges. A wind from the south carried sea salt and a hint of tanneries. Ilion was a sprawling city, easily as large as Camelin or Kyrian. Brightly colored roof tiles and hundreds of thrusting towers gleaming in the sun were just visible across that sea of grass, where long-legged cranes waited and flocks of white birds flew low, uttering shrill cries. Ilion had never needed walls, not that walls would have done the city any good against him. There was considerable disappointment that he did not mean to enter Ilion, though no one spoke a complaint, at least not where he could hear. Still, there were plenty of glum faces and sour mutters as hasty camps began going up. Like most of the great cities, Ilion had a name for exotic mystery, free-handed tapsters, and willing women, at least among men who had never been there, even when it was their own capital. Ignorance always inflated a city's reputation for such things. As it was, only more galloped off across the causeway. Men straightened from hammering tent pegs or setting picket lines for the horses, and followed him with jealous eyes.
Nobles watched curiously while trying to pretend they were not. The Ashaman with Gedwin paid more no mind as they made their own camp, which consisted of a pitch-black tent for Gedwin and Rochad, and a space where damp brown grass and mud were squeezed flat and dry for the rest to sleep wrapped in their cloaks. That was done with the power, of course. They did everything with the power, not even bothering to build cook fires. A few in the other camps stared at them, wide-eyed, as the tent seemed to spring up of its own accord and hampers floated away from pack saddles. But most looked anywhere else at all once they realized what was going on. Two or three of the black-coated soldiers appeared to be talking to themselves. Lynn and the others did not join Gedwin's lot. They had a pair of tents that went up not far from Rand's, but Dashiva wandered over to where the storm leader and the attack leader were standing at their ease, and occasionally issuing a sharp order. A few words, and he wandered back, shaking his head and muttering angrily under his breath. Gedwin and Rochide were not a friendly pair. As well they were not. Rand took to his tent as soon as it was pitched, and sprawled fully clothed down his cot, staring at the sloped ceiling. There were bees embroidered on the inside as well, on a false roof made of silk. Hopwill brought a steaming pewter mug of mulled wine. Rand had left his servants behind, but the wine grew cold on his writing table. His mind worked feverishly. Two or three more days, and the Seanchan would have been dealt a blow that knocked them on their heels. Then it was back to Kyrian to see how negotiations with the sea folk had gone, to learn what Cadswain was after. He owed her a debt, but she was after something. Maybe to put a final end to what remained of the rebellion there. Had Caroline Damodred and Darlin Cisnera slipped away in the confusion? The High Lord Darlin in his hands might finish the rebellion in Tyr as well. Andor. If Matt and Elaine were in Murundi the way it appeared, it would be weeks more at best before Elaine could claim the Lion Throne. Once that happened, he would have to stay clear of Camelin. But he had to talk to Nynaeve. Could he cleanse Sidene? It might work. It might destroy the world, too. Lutheran gibbered at him in stark terror. Light. Where was Narishma? A Simaras storm swept in, all the fiercer this near the sea. Rain beat his tent like a drum. Lightning flashes filled the entrance with blue-white light, and thunder rumbled, the sound like mountains tumbling across the land. Out of that, Narishma stepped into the tent, dripping wet, dark hair plastered to his head. His orders had been to avoid notice at all cost. No flaunting for him. His sodden coat was plain brown, and his dark hair was tied back, not braided. Even without bells, near-waist-length hair on a man attracted eyes. He wore a scowl, too, and under his arm he carried a cylindrical bundle, tied with cord, fatter than a man's leg, like a small carpet. Springing from the cot, Rand snatched the bundle before Narishma could proffer it. "Did anyone see you?" he demanded. "What took you so long? I expected you last night." "It took a while to figure out what I had to do," Narishma replied in a flat voice. "You didn't tell me everything. You nearly killed me." That was ridiculous. Rand had told him everything he needed to know. He was sure of it. There was no point to trusting the man as far as he had, only to have him die and ruin everything. Carefully, he tucked the bundle beneath his cot. His hands trembled with the urge to strip the wrappings away, to make sure they held what Narishma had been sent for. The man would not have dared return if they did not. "Get yourself into a proper coat before you join the others," he said. "And Narishma?" Rand straightened, fixing the other man with a steady gaze. "You tell anyone about this, and I will kill you."
"Kill the whole world,"
Luz Theron laughed, a moan of derision, of despair.
"I killed the world, and you can, too, if you try hard."
Narishma struck himself hard in the chest with his fist. "As you command, my lord dragon," he said sourly. Bright and early the next morning, 1,000 men of the Legion of the Dragon marched out of Ilion, across the causeway of the Northern Star, stepping to the steady beat of drums. Well, it was early anyway. Thick gray clouds roiled across the sky, and a stiff sea breeze, sharp with salt, whipped cloaks and banners, muttering of another storm on the way. The Legion attracted a good bit of attention from the armsmen already in the camp, with their blue-painted Andoran helmets and their long blue coats worked on the chest with a red-and-gold dragon. A blue pennant bearing the dragon and a number marked each of the five companies. The Legion men were different in many ways.
For instance, they wore breastplates, but beneath their coats so as not to hide the dragons, the same reason the coats buttoned up one side. And every man carried a short sword at his hip, and a steel-armed crossbow. Everyone shouldered exactly the same as every other. The officers walked, each with a tall red plume on his helmet, just ahead of drum and pennant. The only horses were Moore's mouse-colored gelding at their head, and pack animals at the rear.
"Foot!" Wireman muttered, slapping his reins on a gauntleted hand. "Burn my soul, they're no good, Foot! They'll scatter at the first charge! Before!"
The first of the column strode off the causeway. They had helped take Ilion, and they had not scattered. Samaradrid shook his head.
"No pikes," he muttered. "I have seen well-led Foot hold with pikes, but without..."
He made a sound of disgust in his throat. Gregorin Panar, the third man sitting his saddle near Rand to watch the new arrivals, said nothing. Perhaps he had no prejudice against infantry, though if he did not, he would be one of only a handful of noblemen Rand had met without it. But he tried hard not to frown, and almost succeeded. Everyone knew by now that the men with the dragon on their chests bore arms because they had chosen to follow Rand, chosen to follow the dragon reborn. For no other reason than that they wanted to. The Ilioner had to be wondering where they were going that Rand wanted the Legion, and the Council of Nine was not trusted to know. For that matter, Samaradrid eyed Rand sideways. Only Wireman was too stupid to think. Rand turned Tidashar away. Narishma's package had been rewrapped into a thinner bundle and tied beneath his left stirrup leather. "Strike the camp. We're moving," he told the three nobles. This time, he let Dashiva weave the gateway to take them all away. The plain-faced fellow frowned at him and mumbled to himself. Dashiva actually seemed affronted for some reason. And Gedwin and Rochide, their horses shoulder by shoulder, watched with sardonic smiles as the silvery slash of light rotated into a hole in nothing. Watched Rand more than Dashiva? Well, let them watch. How often could he see Sayadin and risk falling dizzily on his face before he really did fall? It could not be where they could see. This time the gateway took them to a wide road carved through the low, brushy foothills of mountains to the west. The Namarlan Mountains. Not the equals of the Mountains of Mist, and not a patch on the spine of the world, but they rose dark and severe against the sky, sharp peaks that walled the west coast of Ilion. Beyond them lay Cabal Deep, and beyond that... Men began to recognize the peaks soon enough. Gregorin Panar took one look around and nodded in sudden satisfaction. The other three counselors and Marklin reined close to him to talk while horsemen were still pouring through the gateway. Samaradrid required only a bit longer to puzzle it out, and to Hera, and they also looked as if they understood now. The Silver Road ran from the city to Lugard and carried all of the inland trade for the west. There was a Gold Road, too, that led to Far Matting. Roads and names alike dated from before there had been an Ilion. Centuries of wagon wheels, hooves, and boots had beaten them hard, and the Samaros could only skim them with mud. They were among the few reliable highways in Ilion for moving large groups of men in winter. Everyone knew about the Seanchan in Ebudar by this time, though a good many of the tales Rand had heard among the armsmen made the invaders seem Trolloc's meaner cousins. If the Seanchan intended to strike into Ilion, the Silver Road was a good place to gather for defense. Samaradrid and the others thought they knew what he planned. He must have learned that the Seanchan were coming, and the Ashaman were there to destroy them when they did. Given the stories about the Seanchan, no one seemed too upset that that left little for them to do. Of course, Wireman had to have it explained to him finally, by Tahera, and he was upset, though he tried to mask it behind a grand speech about the wisdom of the Lord Dragon and the military genius of the Lord of the Morning, along with how he, personally, would lead the first charge against these Seanchan. A pure bull-goose fool. With luck, anyone else who learned of a gathering on the Silver Road would at least not be much brighter than Samaradrid or Gregorin. With luck, no one who mattered would learn before it was too late. Settling into wait, Rand thought, it would only be another day or so, but as the days stretched out, he began to wonder whether he might be nearly as big a fool as Wireman. Most of the Ashaman were out searching across Ilion and Tyr and the plains of Meredo for the rest of those Rand wanted. Searching through the Samaros.
Gateways and traveling were all very well, but even Ashaman took time to find who they sought when downpours hit anything 50 paces away, and quagmires dragged rumor to a near halt. Searching Ashaman passed within a mile of their quarry in ignorance, and turned only to learn the men had moved on again. Some had farther to go, seeking people not necessarily eager to be found. Days passed before the first brought news. The High Lord Sunaman joined Wireman, a fat man with an unctuous manner, toward Rand at least. Smooth in his fine silk coat, always smiling, he was voluble in his declarations of loyalty, but he had plotted against Rand so long that he probably did so in his sleep. The High Lord Torian came, with his lumpy farmer's face and his vast wealth, stammering about the honor of riding once more at the Lord Dragon's side. Gold concerned Torian more than anything else, except possibly the privileges Rand had taken away from the nobles in Tyr. He seemed particularly dismayed to learn there were no serving girls in the camp, and not so much as a village nearby where compliant farm girls might be found. Torian had schemed against Rand every bit as often as Sunamon, maybe even more than Guayam or Marakan or Aracom. There were others. There was Bertum Saigon, a short, ruggedly handsome man with the front of his head shaved. He supposedly did not mourn the death of his cousin Colaver too greatly, both because that made him the new high seat of House Saigon, and because rumor said Rand had executed her. Or murdered her. Bertome bowed and smiled, and his smile never reached his dark eyes. Some said he had been very fond of his cousin. Isla Riotan came, a slim, dignified woman with big dark eyes, not young, but quite pretty, protesting that she had a lance captain to lead her armsmen, and no desire to take the field in person. Protesting her loyalty for the Lord Dragon, too. But her brother Toran claimed the throne Rand meant for Elaine, and it was whispered that she would do anything for Toram, anything at all. Even join with his enemies, to hamper or to spy, or both, of course. Dauthanas Annalyn came, and Amondred O'Sealan, and Doresen Chuliandred, lords who had supported Colaver's seizure of the Sun Throne when they thought Rand would never return to Cairhien. Cairhienin and Tyran, they were brought in one by one, with 50 retainers, or at most 100.